Philippians 4, verses 10 through 13. This will be the last week that I do a detour from 1 John. We will go back to that starting in verse 5 next week. If you're a visitor with us today, I got to the fact that Christians are supposed to have joy. I got off on that and did a five-week series on joy and joy robbers. That was the idea. And this would be the last installment of that. And I've titled the sermon, The Joy of Being Content. As you look around our world today, these are days of discontentment. Webster defines discontentment as a restless desire for something one does not have, or being dissatisfied with one's life or the situation or circumstances. And I say that because we're discontented with the way we look. We're discontented by that which we possess. Sometimes we're discontented with our spouses, our jobs, our circumstances. And I don't mean to hijack this, but we're discontented even with what gender we are. I mean, you know, you've been watching it, you know. Bruce is now Caitlin. You know, this is a huge discontentment. As I was preparing this, I thought, well, yeah, I mean, people are really just discontented, you know. And I found this comic here. These two people up in heaven. He says, to be honest, I think it's a bit of a letdown being up here. You can laugh. Get it? He's discontented with heaven. He thought it would be better than this, okay? Go ahead, take it off. That was a bad thing, I guess. I thought it was funny. Talk about the height of discontentment, right? Yes. But we're living in a day where there's a rapid change and there's uncertainty, and it may well be that the greatest lesson that we have to learn is how to not let our circumstances affect our contentment. I mean, I one of the things that when you prepare a certain sermon all week long, I was rebuked when I found myself murmuring or complaining or discontented with some sort of situation. So I've been living in this for a whole week, and I got to see that, I got to practice what I preach. But, we're becoming more and more dependent on things around us, the things that are done for us. And it's part of society that we become dependent on things and electronic gadgets. I'm not going to use this as a soapbox for that, but I will to some extent. We depend on our electronic gadgets for amusement, for entertainment, to connect with others, our news, our commerce, and we become more and more dependent on these things to organize our lives. And I read this quote this week about in the early days of World War II, there were some regulations imposed. And it was common to hear of something called blackout, discontentment, or boredom. And what it was is people found it impossible to spend a few nights in their homes doing nothing. They had been so dependent on the radio or the TV or going to the cinema or something like that, that they didn't know what to do with themselves. My father always had a solution for that, right? You didn't want to tell him that you were bored. There was always a ditch to dig or a hole to dig or a garden to hoe or something like that. But in our society, there's a danger of that, isn't there? Like, I can't watch TV, I can't play with my iPhone, what am I going to do with my life? Yeah, you poor thing, that's what my dad would say. I got something for you to do. Usually it was work. But it was something that I could accomplish, and I felt good about myself. So in the end, he was right. But We become dependent on people and things filling our time. And we become restless and we can become discontented with just plain old, you know. Calling a friend and talking to them. But at any rate, so this Puritan writer, Jeremiah Burroughs, described Christian contentment as a rare jewel. And this week I realized that a lot of times I was rebuked because I was like, well, that's not being content. And especially in our day and age when we're so prone to put contentment on acquiring something. If I get that, then I'll be content. And so we allow situations and possessions and circumstances to destroy our contentment. And Paul says something in Philippians 4 here, starting in verse 10. He says, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that at last you have renewed your concern for me. Indeed, you have been concerned, but you had no opportunity to show it. I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content. Whatever the circumstances, I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. You know, this word content, and bear with me because I know right away you'll want to sort of arrange what I'm saying, but it means to be self-sufficient. That's what content means. It means that I can be content independent of my circumstances or my conditions or that there's a sufficiency that I have within myself that I don't need those things to be content. We see that in the book of Acts with Paul and Silas, remember? They're in the jail, they're beaten, their feet are in stocks, it's around midnight, and their physical condition could have been worse, and there they are praying and singing songs to God. It says in Acts 16:25, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. And remember, you got the fans on. You remember that Paul also writes to Timothy about this principle. He says it's good, you know, godliness is good if it's matched with contentment. So they go together. Timothy, no matter what's happening in your life, just consider that it's God's divine sovereignty, and you can be content in that. Remember, Christ told us that, right? He told us that in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food? And the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or stow away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Of course, my wife feeds them also. But are you not much more valuable than they? It's Mother Nature, by the way. She feeds the birds all the time. But, you know, this idea that irrespective, I think that's the right word, of our circumstances, we can be content because we have a Heavenly Father who's going to take care of us. And Paul says this was something he learned. I don't think naturally in our normal nature, you know, our base nature, I was going to say. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. But we don't come into this world actually content. Let's just put it that way. But Paul said he learned it. And it was a learning process and a struggle back and forth. But at this point, he says, I learned the lesson, trade acquired. I'm content in any situation. That's what he says in verse 13. I learned the secret of contentment. And that word secret was a word that they used in the mystery religions to describe people who had worked their way up through lower degrees and finally were in possession of this secret. It wasn't that it couldn't be found out, but they found it out and they learned it. So Paul is saying in no uncertain terms that he's learned it. He's learned to say whatever situation is, as we'll sing in closing, it is well with my soul. And you know, that's a sign of a mature believer. I want you to know that. Not that we're always there 100%, but when we stop and think about it, we can say that I'm content with my lot in life and my circumstances. Now, as I was doing the study, I'm very analytical, and I can hear somebody saying, "Well, yeah, but, should I be content? Does it mean that I should be indifferent to my circumstances?" Because for years, people have used this as a way to say, to keep people under bondage. Let's say, okay, just accept it. I have to be content. Does that mean putting up with disgraceful or unjust conditions? Is that what content means? Does it teach that a man should be content in poverty? Oh, I'm poor and I'm just going to be poor and I'm going to not do anything about it and I'm content with that. That he should never make an effort to better himself or the world around him? No, what the Apostle Paul is saying that no matter what situation he's in, even if he's making efforts to better himself, that he will not be mastered or controlled by his circumstances. Do you get that? So he's working towards betterment, but he's not going to, in the meantime, be murmuring and be discontent. He's doing something about it. And you know, Thomas A. Edison said this. He's a great inventor, in case you don't know. Discontent is the first necessity of progress. You know, I worked in a firm at Step 2, and they're all designers. Do you know, those people were the most discontent people I ever met. But they were discontented about the products that they were getting and trying to make them better. Edison may have thought, you know, this fire that I got, you know, I can't really see that well, and it smells in the house, and, you know, maybe I can make a light bulb. You know, I mean, so some discontentment, there is a holy discontent too. I just want to say that parenthetically, that you should not be content to be not victorious in your Christian life. You should not be content when the enemy around you is ravishing and plundering and sending people to hell. There is a holy discontent. But if you find yourself in trying and very difficult situations, what Paul's saying, don't let it master you. Don't let it rob you of your joy. Don't let it rob you of your joy. That's what this series is about. A discontentment can be a joy robber. So my joy and happiness shouldn't revolve around what's happening to me. You know, and it's interesting too that Paul says, whether I have a lot or whether I'm debased. I think King James, whether I'm in a state of want or I have plenty, I'm content. And we all understand that, right? When I'm in want, that's when we tend to be discontented. But he says, look it, there's another side of this too. That when you have plenty, because what's the problem when we have plenty? We forget God. We don't go to him. I mean, look at the believers in the church of Laodicea in Revelation had lost their first love, and they didn't realize what a dangerous spiritual condition they had because they had plenty. It says of them that their true condition was they're wretched, pitiful, poor, and blind. But when they took inventory of their lives, they said, look it, I'm rich. I've increased in goods and I have need of nothing. So whether you have want or plenty, there's I can't make the case what you think is worse. to be in want or have plenty. That's up for you. But we tend to forget God. Poverty can be a snare to us, and also riches can be a snare to us. But no matter what, Paul viewed himself as a victor over those circumstances. And you can have the victory. You can be content in life. You say, well, why? You going to get to that part? Yeah, I'm going to get to the part right now. Verse 13 says it all. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Who is the him that he's talking about? Some translations interject that for you. Through Christ. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. That's where my self-sufficiency comes from. That I'm sufficient in him. I'm sufficient in him. You know, I want you to turn to Psalm 131 for me in closing. I want to show you something that's just a beautiful psalm. Psalm 131. Thank you for your attention to it. It's only three verses long. Charles Spurgeon said about that, that it's one of the shortest, but one of the hardest lessons to learn. It's a short ladder, yet rises to a great height. And here's what it says. Here's what this, David the psalmist writes. He says, my heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me, O Israel. Put your hope in the Lord both now and forevermore. The key word that I want to bring out in the psalm is this idea of weaned or weaning. And interestingly enough, David's saying that he's not always been in this state. Just as Paul said, I've learned how to be content. He says that, he's saying that he's reflecting on that difficult weaning process. Yeah, mothers, right? You've weaned your children. Men, you've seen that happen, right? Where the child, I mean, look at, you start to wean those child off the mother's milk and you know, it's they have a fit, some of them. I think one of our children made the transition a lot better than the other, but temper tantrums, it's no picnic. You know, for the mother to look down and say, the child's looking up like, what? I'm done? You're kidding me, you know? But weaning is necessary for that child to mature. So mother knows best. But the unweaned child prefers mother's milk and the comfort of the accustomed. Same way with us. God weans us from things that we need to be content. Right? I mean, that's the link here, you know. So that we can receive the solid food that we desired. And here's a key thing. The weaning that brings us contentment in the Lord takes place through loss. What brings us contentment in life, the school of contentment, comes through the fact that he makes us go through loss. Isn't that interesting? It's not because he gives us everything we want or that he pampers us. We learn to be content from the things that we lose. Things that we naturally want. But he doesn't give us what we think we want, but he gives us what we need. And David says, look, through this weaning process, I've learned to trust God. I've come to terms with God knows best. So I would say that a Christian comes to contentment not so much by way of addition, but by way of subtraction. Not because what God adds to his life. The contentment comes from what he thinks he needs and what God gives him. The members of the Episcopal Church have a prayer that they're encouraged to pray daily. It goes like this. Lord, give us minds always contented with our present condition and circumstances. That's a short prayer, but it's a great one. Lord, today give my mind and my soul and everything, my will, content with what I have and what my present condition in life is. Do you ever meet somebody who's never happy with where they're at? My, you don't want to be around that person. Right? Here, three things in closing. Like the Apostle Paul, David had fought and won the battle for contentment. Here's how he did it. Verse 1, he guarded the ambitions of his heart. He said, my heart is not proud. Or, Lord, my eyes are not haughty. In other words, he no longer assumes that he knows what's best for him. That's the great matters. See, I always assume I know what's best for me. Don't you? I mean, I get it after a while, but that my default mode is I know what's best for me, and I'm not getting what I want best, and I'm discontented with life because this is what I want. But he's gotten to the place where he says, my heart is not proud, or Lord, my eyes too haughty. He's come to the point where he's content in God's sovereignty and oversight of his life. Number one. Number two, he controlled the preoccupations of his mind. He says, I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. He deliberately refused to let his mind be preoccupied with things that were beyond him, beyond his possession. He says, no, it's enough to be in the Lord's hands. Because the weaning process does not necessarily remove the mother from the child. The child still takes comfort in that the mother's nearby. It's enough, he says, to be in the Lord's hands. I'm not God, he is. I don't understand everything. But in this life, I see through a mirror dimly. That's just the way things are. We don't see the whole picture. The third thing, as David said, he stilled and quieted his soul. Soul means your mind, your will, your affections in life. Like a weaned child with its mother, like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. Both David and Paul learned the most valuable lesson to put their trust and hope in the Lord. That he's a good God. That he's a loving God. And of course, we have the cross now. We get to see just how much he loves us and how much he cares for us. They learned how in every trial, in every circumstance, even though it's a challenge that God brought to their lives, they knew God was adequate. That's what Paul says. I can do all that God requires of me. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. I'm a self-sufficient unit because I am endowed with the Spirit of God. Christ in me. We are to be content people. Because the world sees that, right? You're not contented. Great verse in Hebrews 13:5, and I'm going to close with this. He says, let your conversation, which is another way to say, let your way of life, let everything about your life be without covetousness. And I use the King James Version because it's not just about money. It's about acquisition. It's about my job. It's about so many other things that we covet, that we want, which is in a way saying an affront to God's goodness, that He's not giving me something I need. And so we covet. He says, let your conversation, your way of life, be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. Contentment. And then he gives this great promise. For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Let's stand.